Yeah, well, good morning, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be actually giving a talk here on these occasions. It's like I can't help mentioning it's also sort of a great pleasure to be doing it to the background of pneumatic drills on the building site. So this building we've been talking about for years, as you can now undoubtedly see, is actually happening. Anyway, so this morning I'm just going to set the ball rolling, so to speak, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about the state of science as it was before relativity, and then I will kind of work our way through to the point where we sort of got Einstein's equations with a little bit of hand waving. And having established what Einstein's equations are, then we'll stop for coffee and a break. And then after the break, James and Pedro will show you how actually, although these equations look horrible, you can actually make some kind of progress with connecting them to physics. Okay, so in the second half of the 19th century, of course, quite a lot was known about physics, right? I mean, the 19th century in particular was a century in which an enormous amount was accomplished in terms of understanding the natural world. But in fact, gravity, you know, of course, long predated 19th century physics. It was first written down by Newton in the form that we all know. And Newton's gravity is a force law. So what Newton wrote down was this force law. You have a force between two masses. It's attractive always. It's proportional to the two masses. It's inversely proportional to their separation. And there is some constant there, capital G, which is Newton's constant, which basically tells you kind of how strong gravity is. Now, in this picture, basically what you do is you then take Newton's second law and so on, and you use this force in Newton's equations of motion, and you solve Newton's equations of motion, and you find out what happens to the objects. So space and time in this picture are forming a fixed canvas on which all the action is happening. Okay? It's a fixed reference system. The position, the time just ticks away with the clock, and the position is the position of an object. The other thing about this force, if you look at this formula, is that it's what's known as action at a distance or instantaneous. So if I take one of these masses and I move one of them a bit, the force between the two objects, according to this formula, changes immediately. And that, of course, will turn out to be a bit of a problem. Okay. Now, in 1687, when this was all first written down by Newton, it was a triumph. Suddenly a whole swathe of astronomical observations are explained by a single principle. It's just fantastic. Right? You know you've done something right when suddenly you write down something, it explains a whole slew of things which were not really understood in any connected way before. That's a triumph. And in 1890, it was still working pretty well, but there were a couple of chinks in the armour. One of the very interesting things in the 19th century physics and mathematics is that there were some people who were really tremendously hard workers, right? And, you know, really very hard workers. And Le Verrier was one of them. So Le Verrier did very high order perturbation theory calculations in Newtonian dynamics. And he analyzed in great detail the orbits of the planets. Okay? And in particular, he analyzed the orbits of Uranus, which was not quite right according to everything that was known in the solar system. So, of course, the main forces in the solar system come from the Sun and from Jupiter, which is very big, and then there are minor perturbations from the other planets. Le Verrier worked to seventh order in perturbation theory by hand, no computers, right? And showed that there was indeed an anomaly in the orbit of Uranus. But you could remove this anomaly by hypothesizing that there was a new planet. Okay, this is a great trick, right, in physics. If you hypothesize the existence of a new something, which explains all kinds of stuff, right, and then somebody goes and finds it, this is always reckoned to be cool. And so Le Verrier hypothesized that this problem with the orbit of Uranus could be solved by introducing a new planet, which ultimately became known as Neptune. And he worked out its exact location, exactly where it needed to be, and what its orbit was. His paper was actually announced in Paris on the 31st of August, 1846. For some reason, it took a little while for the news to get to Berlin, where these two other guys, Gall and Darest, were. But on the morning of the 23rd of September, the prediction arrived in Berlin. Right? And by midnight on the 23rd of September, so history had it, they'd already found the planet. So this was a tremendous triumph. It also shows you how easy science was in those days, right? Somebody makes a prediction, and the same day, when somebody else who hears about it confirms it, right? You know, that's really pretty fast. There was another anomaly in the motion of the planets, though, which was the behaviour of the perihelion of Mercury. The perihelion of Mercury processes anyway, and you can compute some part of the contribution comes from the existing planets, but the calculation is wrong, and actually Le Verrier repeated the trick with the perihelion of Mercury. He worked out where there needed to be an extra planet to explain it. Unfortunately, this time when the observers went to look at it, it was not there. Right? So the method was pretty good. It worked for Uranus, it worked for Neptune, but it didn't explain the perihelion of Mercury. So that was an outstanding problem. One of the other great triumphs of 19th century physics was electromagnetism, of course, and that culminated in Maxwell's unification of the various phenomenological laws which have been discovered up to that point by Faraday and people. Okay? In case you've forgotten, these are Maxwell's equations in units where the speed of light is conveniently set equal to 1. Okay. And we're not going to do anything with Maxwell's equations today, except to note that they're actually kind of quite simple. Yeah. These are the microscopic Maxwell's equations. E is the electric field, B is the magnetic field, rho is the charge density, J is the current density, and these are linear equations. Okay, these are linear in E and B. So basically, they always say some differential operator on E or B is equal to the source term, the charge or the current. Out of these, a whole slew of stuff also came. So you can compute in this that light is an electromagnetic wave which travels with a finite speed, which you can calculate. Okay? And that was sort of reassuring because Fizeau had already measured the speed of light. So it was already known that light travelled at a finite speed, about 300,000 kilometres a second. Another consequence working on from that was that all signals in this theory travel at the speed of light. Okay, and we no longer have action at a distance. If you repeat that thing where you take two charges this time and you move one of the charges, then the force on the one sitting over here does not change instantaneously if you actually solve these equations. The news only arrives once a light signal has had time to travel from here to here. So that kind of that feels right. This is all internally inconsistent picture, a finite propagation of information, and you see that turning up in all sorts of ways, including in the influence of one body on another. The thing which was not quite right at this point was that Maxwell's equations actually have some different properties from Newton's laws, and in particular, they transform differently between relatively moving reference frames. Okay, so this is a little bit technical. And it doesn't matter very much, but in the context of this morning's lectures. But it was a serious issue at the time, and of course that was one of the things that led to later developments. And the reason why it's so those are basically the Galilean transformations. I have two reference frames, one which is x and y and z, and I have another set of coordinates which is x prime, y prime, and z prime. And the second set is moving relative to the first set with some speed v. Then if you work out the relationship between the coordinates, then the transverse coordinates don't change, y and z don't change, and the time doesn't change. The time is just a clock going tick, tick, tick. But x prime is not equal to x. It's x minus the speed times the time that this has been going, which is sort of obvious. Now, Maxwell's equations are not invariant under this set of transformations. They're very, very messy, and that means that you would have to choose a preferred frame in order to define electromagnetism if these transformations were to be the law. Okay. Now, Lorentz and Larmor realised, actually, you can fix this, but in order to fix it, time has to transform non-trivially. Come on. And they came up with the transformations on the right. So these are the Lorentz transformations. They're written down with the speed of light equal to 1. Some of you probably have vague memories of these things. You may even have learnt about them in this lecture theatre. I had lectures from Dick Dalitz in this lecture theatre on special relativity a long time ago. So the transformations, these transformations are of course interesting in that the Galilean transformation of X is multiplied by this gamma factor, the square root of 1 minus V squared inverse. But the time is also changed. Okay, and this leads, of course, to all the time dilation and so on phenomena, which you're used to as part of special relativity. Okay. Now, the thing about special relativity, when Einstein sort of pulled this together and published the theory of special relativity in 1905, and the basic point is that it's a completely consistent theory of electromagnetism and mechanics. You no longer have a situation where your theory of electromagnetism, Maxwell's equations, is slightly inconsistent with your theory of mechanics, which is basically given by Newton's laws. The whole lot is now self-consistent, and the correct transformation laws between relatively moving frames are not the Galilean transformations, but the Lorentz transformations. That's great, but there are some serious consequences. Right? One of the most serious consequences is that time itself is no longer absolute. Okay? Time is observer independent. Notice the time changes between frames. It's no longer a single clock going tick, 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 which specifies the time everywhere for everybody. Okay. So time is observer dependent, and our notion of simultaneity is completely changed by this. Okay. What happens is, as most of you probably remember, that basically the important object is the light cone. So here we have space going horizontally, we have time going vertically, and we've killed the other two space dimensions because I'm no good as a draftsman, right? And so if you consider this little point in the middle at the origin, the diagonal lines are the paths which will be followed by rays of light. Okay, the slope of this line is the velocity of light, speed of light, sorry. So if you start out at this dot as a light ray, then you will go up one of the diagonals. Okay. You start out as something which is moving more slowly, you will move more close to the axis. Okay. You won't get as far in a given time as light will. Okay. So, and the same goes in the backward direction. So the backward direction inside this light cone is in the past. At any point in this area here, if you start at that point and you wait, you can propagate up and meet the little dot, okay, by traveling at the speed of light or less. Okay? And similarly, if you go up into the upper half, that's the future of that point. The places to one side are neither the past nor the future. Okay? And that's very different from the Galilean situation, where basically everything above the x-axis is the future, and everything below the x-axis is the past, and what lies on the x-axis is simultaneous with the event at the dot in the middle. So these coordinates, as we said, are observer-independent, but the invariant interval, so this object, which I've called ds squared, which is made up of the little shifts in x and little shifts in t between two events, this does turn out to be invariant. Okay, and it was an undergraduate exercise to take the Lorentz transformations and show that this was true. And I can see some nodding heads, which is very encouraging. So this does not depend on which reference frame you're in. Okay. So the thing to note about this is that the light rays actually follow straight lines. They follow the lines ds squared is equal to 0. And in this kind of picture, initially parallel trajectories remain so. So if you have two points along this x-axis, where two things start moving, and they move parallel to each other up the page, they will just carry on moving parallel. So those are some of the features of special relativity in a very, very quick, very shorthand sort of way. Okay. Now, Newtonian gravity is not consistent with this picture, okay, because the action of the force is instantaneous or at a distance. So Newtonian gravity does not fit into the picture of special relativity. Now, actually, it would have been possible to, at that point, to emulate Maxwellian dynamics and actually to write down a set of equations which look a bit like the ones we were looking at a few minutes ago, but are more complicated, which would have been consistent with Lorentz transformations, okay, and could have been absorbed into the special relativistic picture and would have described gravity in the weak field limit. That set of equations does exist, okay, and you can write them down. But Einstein didn't take that approach, and he followed a rather different line of reasoning. And I think it's very important to realise that ultimately, whether one line of reasoning or the other is the right way to do it is ultimately determined by experiment and observations. You know, it's very easy to write down theories which are very elegant, but they don't actually describe what you observe, right? The fascinating thing about general relativity is that he in fact does turn out to describe what we observe in very non-trivial circumstances. So Einstein built his picture of what was going on around the notion of equivalence. So equivalence is basically the observation that when you have bodies in a gravitational field, they basically follow the same space-time trajectory independent of their mass. Now, this sort of started with, the Tower of Pisa, right? So the Leaning Tower of Pisa, people were dropping things, somebody whose name I temporarily forget, was dropping, somebody was dropping things off the tower, and it doesn't really matter whether you dropped a pebble or a big piece of rock, it would hit the ground at the same time. So these two objects are actually following the same trajectory, although their mass is very different. And that's reflected, of course, in the Newtonian formula, okay? Because the Newtonian formulation says that the force is this gmm over r squared. That's the force, and that ought to be equal to the mass times the acceleration. Okay, so there's the mass there. That's the gravitational mass. That's telling you how big the gravitational force is on the object. And this is the inertial mass, which multiplies the acceleration. And, of course, they're the same. And therefore, they cancel out of this formula. So that means that when you then solve this to find out the position as a function of time, it's independent of what that little mass is. Of course, it's dependent on what the big mass is, because it's the big mass which is providing the gravitational influence. So this is basically, equivalence is basically the observation, in one way of looking at it, that the gravitational mass is equal to inertial mass, and therefore that you have this phenomenon that bodies in the gravitational field don't behave in a way which depends on their own mass. So Einstein then went one step further, and the argument was, well, if the behavior of bodies in the gravitational field does not depend on the mass of the bodies, it must be an intrinsic property of the space-time that they're moving in. Okay. And therefore, that the gravitational influence of a massive body is to distort the space-time. So rather than generating some field which acts on a fixed space and time, what you do is you distort the space-time itself. And then, of course, you have to explain how that explains how bodies move, right? What are the trajectories of bodies? So the basic hypothesis is that the trajectory of a body moving under the influence of gravity is a geodesic of the space-time. Now, we'll talk about geodesics more in a minute. Geodesics are basically the shortest possible paths. So these two statements in italics are the essence of general relativity. They're basically the things that Einstein had to postulate in order to make a theory of gravity which described how things moved under the influence of gravitational forces. So you throw out this notion that you have a field on a fixed space-time, you replace it with a space-time which is itself affected by the gravitating mass, the big mass of the sun, for example, and you hypothesize that particles moving in this gravitational field follow geodesics in the space-time. Now, that's very different from just emulating Maxwell's equations, which I was talking about a couple of minutes ago, and whether it's right is ultimately an experimental and observational question. There were lots of kind of discussions about this, and Einstein himself spent lots of time discussing it. And of course, there are many ramifications of this kind of picture. Right? And Einstein actually coined the term Max principle for some of them. It's kind of interesting that Max was a philosopher, not a physicist. And Einstein, he called it Max principle because Max had talked about these things. I kind of suspect he wanted it to be somebody else's principle, not his own, right? Because these discussions are all a little bit on the vague side. But basically, one consequence is immediately clear, okay? That you don't really have the notion of an independent inertial observer anymore. And the reason for that is that the structure of space-time everywhere, is determined by what's there. Okay? So all of the stuff which is creating gravitational fields, all the planets, all the galaxies and so on, okay, they're all creating gravitational field, but now they're not creating a gravitational field in the old sense, they are distorting space-time. Okay? Actually, the observer, him or her, or itself, is also distorting space-time, right? Because the idea of a massless, energy-less, etc. observer is kind of absurd. So the observer, you cannot have an observer who somehow kind of decouples themselves from what's going on, goes and stands and watches everything that's going on from some kind of Olympian place. The observer is in what's going on, the observer disturbs what's going on, okay? And basically, when you see something through a space-time, like you see a distant star or a distant planet or light from it, okay, then you can really only correctly interpret what is seen by knowing what's happening to it in between, because the space-time in between is distorted in some way. And in fact, turning that on its head is something that James will talk about in his talk, and becomes a huge, valuable tool in actually working out what's in between, if you hypothesize that you know what's at the far end. Okay, so to actually make any kind of progress with implementing this idea, of course, we need a little bit of mathematics, and we need to be able to describe this kind of stuff in a bit more detail. So what are the basic elements of general relativity from a mathematical point of view? Well, the most important object is the metric. Okay, so the metric is the thing which describes this invariant interval ds squared, basically it's basically you take all possible combinations of dx, dy, dz, and dt and multiply them together, right, and then multiply them by some coefficient, which is the corresponding coefficient g. And if you write all of this out, it's quite long. That's why it says dot, 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 right? Because if you take four objects and multiply them all together pairwise, you get quite a few combinations. And so we need a more compact notation. So what we do is we describe this guy x mu, okay? And x mu has four components, which are basically x0, x1, x2, and x3. So mu, or Greek letter, always runs from 0 to 3. And those components are actually c times the time, and the x and the y and the z coordinates. So that's a thing which is called a four-vector in special relativity. And G is actually a 4x4 matrix. Okay, it's made up of all of these elements. It has various characteristics. It's symmetric, for example. And then the invariant element, the invariant distance, is basically, as I've written down at the bottom, the sum over all of these combinations. Right, so it's a sum over mu and nu, metric tensor, g mu nu, dx mu, dx nu. Writing down sums all over the place itself gets tedious, okay? So we leave out the sum and adopt the convention that any time an index is repeated, they're summed over, and that's called contracting indices. So this is kind of sort of irreducible minimum of stuff that we need to write down. We need to write down some formulae, okay? Now we'll look at an example of metric in just a moment. Okay, so for flat space-time, the one that we started with, that we have the Minkowski metric. And there, G is very, very, very simple. It's mostly zeros. All the off-diagonal elements are zero. And the diagonal elements are just ones or minus ones. And if you take that metric and you plug it back into the formula on the bottom of the previous slide, you will just get back the original flat space invariant interval that we wrote down. Now, we need an example of a curved space just to convince you this isn't sort of kind of total nonsense, right? So think about the surface of a sphere. Okay, so here's a sphere, and it's got two, and you describe walking over the surface of the sphere using two angular coordinates. So there's a polar angle, so that's the one that takes you from the equator up to the pole. Okay, and then there's the azimuthal angle, which is the angle which takes you around the equator. Now, the distance between two neighbouring points on the surface of this sphere has two bits. It depends on how far in theta you've gone, that's in the polar direction, and it depends on how far in azimuth you have gone. Okay. And capital K here is simply the radius of the sphere. So if you move a certain amount in polar angle, you just move the radius times the change in the angle. If you move a certain amount in azimuthal angle this way, yeah, then the effective radius is shorter, it's k times sine theta, and so the amount you move is k squared sine squared theta d phi squared, that's the amount squared. Okay. Now those two directions are at right angles, so they add up by Pythagoras, and so this is what the metric is. So in terms of g, then the g theta is just k squared, and g phi phi is k squared sine squared theta, and all of the others are zero. Okay. Now, there's one very awkward thing that you have to be careful about when you're dealing with vectors on space-time. And we have to deal with vectors, of course, because we have things moving. Okay. So here's a vector which is tangential over on the left-hand side to a little bit of the surface of the sphere. If I take that vector and I move it round azimuthally to the other side, it'll have moved to something like that. If you just take it and move it carefully around the surface of the sphere, it will end up in roughly the position that I've drawn. Okay. And now you have a question you have to answer, which is, how do you know whether two vectors at different points on the curved surface are the same? On a flat surface, it's very, very easy. What you do is you use Cartesian coordinates, and if the Cartesian coordinates of the two vectors are equal to each other, then the vectors are equal. Okay. But on a curved surface, as this picture shows you, that's not so obvious. So in order to deal with this, there's a notion which has to be adopted, which is called parallel transport. So basically, if you look at this picture, right, with great faith and imagination, yeah, this is an element of the surface of a sphere. That's what it's supposed to be, right? And the sort of purple arrow is the direction of a path which I'm going to start moving the green arrow in, and the green arrow is my vector which I'm going to parallel transport. So what I do is, as I move along the path, the green vector, okay, in the projection that we're looking at, it of course slowly changes direction. At this point, I now, instead of carrying on parallel transporting it around the equator, I'm going to start parallel transporting it up towards the pole. So if I parallel transport it up towards the pole, it sort of goes up like this. And then I get to the pole, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to parallel transport it back down to the starting point. So I keep going. Okay. And here we are. Okay. And I've got back to the starting point, and of course this is kind of a good example, it's very exaggerated, right? I've gone all the way around this path, carefully parallel transporting my vector, and I have ended up with it pointing in a different direction. So what you see from this is that parallel transport along different paths gives different results. Right. You can't do any better than this. Okay, this is as good as you can do. Now, to describe the parallel transport mathematically, we have to introduce another object. So basically, if I gave you a vector in Cartesian space and you just were looking at parallel transporting it, basically what it boils down to is how does the vector change as you change coordinates? Okay, so there's a bit which is straightforward, the derivative, the ordinary derivative of the vector dotted into the tangent, the vector along the direction that you're moving, will tell you the change in this vector v. Okay. And so On a flat space, V would be parallel transported if the direction you were moving it dotted with the grad operator acting on it was zero. So that's basically what a constant vector in Cartesian space. In a curved space, you have this problem that we were just alluding to, which is the vectors kind of appear to change direction in different places. And what that means is that you have to take account of what happens to the basis vectors as you move around the surface. And that's taken care of by this second object, which is called the connection. Now, connections exist in spaces which don't have metrics, actually. But in spaces which are curved and which do have metrics, the connection is basically this object called the Christoffel symbol, right? And it's, you can calculate it in terms of the metric, and it's kind of complicated. Right? It's already looking a bit bad. It's derivatives of the metric. Now, you can work all of this out, but doing all the algebra which works out all the things I'm telling you takes hours, which is why we're not doing it. Right? So the basic message is that there is a notion of parallel transport of vectors, how you move vectors around in curved spaces. Okay, and the notion of parallel transport is encoded in this statement that this covariant derivative, as it's called, of a vector vanishes. Okay? And crucial to that is this object called the connection. Now, we notice that when you parallel transport around a closed path, actually what happens is the vector ends up pointing in a different direction. So can we encapsulate that in some kind of formula? The answer is yes. So this just shows how it works. So I've now got a little square closed path, which is slightly easier to deal with. So what I do is I start at the origin, I go out to the point delta A, then I go up to the point delta A plus delta B, then I go back to the point delta B, and then finally I go back to the origin. And by the time I've done that, my green vector will have changed a little bit. And the change in the vector is given by a sort of big product, if you like. It's delta A times delta B, so the bigger the area, the bigger the change. Now, you can understand that. If you do this on the surface of a sphere, and you just go around a little, tiny little patch on the sphere, the vector will hardly change. Whereas if you do what we did on the previous slide, and go around a big chunk of the sphere, the change will be big. And then the crucial object which determines how much the change is this character which has got no fewer than four indices, right? This is the Riemann tensor. And then the change, not surprisingly, is also proportional to the original vector itself. If you double the length of the original vector, you'd expect the change to double. The Riemann tensor tells you everything about the curvature, it turns out, of the space. It has this sort of intrinsic meaning in terms of what the shift of a vector as you go around a closed, as you parallel transport the vector around a closed path. There are various things that you can do to the Riemann tensor. You can contract out pairs of indices. So if you contract out one pair of indices, you get the Ricci tensor. That's something which is a two-component object. So that's just like an ordinary matrix now. If you contract out the remaining pair, then you get what's called the Ricci scalar. And then there's a very special combination, which is the last one down at the bottom, which is a combination of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar, and that's actually called the Einstein tensor for reasons that we'll come back to in a minute. So that's how curvature is related to what happens to vectors when you go around paths. Then the final ingredient of all of this is, what's a geodesic? Well, a geodesic is a curve whose tangent vector is parallel transported along itself, right, in mathematical terms. What that means is it's the straightest possible path between two points. So on the surface of a sphere, you're familiar with the notion that great circles are the shortest distances, right? So if you travel from London to New York, then you don't head off in a straight, in what looks like southwest or something, right? Actually, you follow a great circle route more or less, and that's the shortest route. You could head off from London in the opposite direction and go the other way round. That would also be a great circle route, right? That's of course the longest possible route, right? So actually geodesics are extrema, right? But if you have a closed space, then there will be longest ones as well as shortest ones. Now, if you then ask what this all writes out as, well, if you have a curve, so which you have these x, the coordinates are given as a function of some intrinsic parameter s, which just as you change s moves you along the curve, right, then the tangent vector, this t, is just the derivative of the curve with respect to s. So if you take that and shove it back in the geodesic condition, then you get this formula that tells you that the second derivative of x plus the connection times these two derivatives, first derivatives of x, is zero. That's the geodesic equation. Okay. And as you can see, it's going to be a second-order differential equation. Now, that's okay, because you expect equations of motion to be second-order equations of motion. The geodesic equation is a second-order equation of motion. So it's possible to envisage that the geodesic equation will, in appropriate circumstances, lead to an equation of motion which looks like what you've got out of Newtonian mechanics. Okay. This is necessary for it to be consistent. The final thing that we need to know about geodesics, and then we're done, is that if you start with two neighbouring geodesics, so I have a picture down the bottom here, so I've got two neighbouring geodesic paths, and with a small distance between them, if I move down the paths, they won't remain parallel. Remember what we said, when space-time is completely flat, these paths always just move parallel. If they start parallel, they stay parallel. But if space-time is curved, that's not the case, their relative separation will change. And the acceleration of their separation, this delta mu double dot, is just, again, proportional to the Riemann tensor. So it's proportional to the amount of curvature. So more curvature equals more relative acceleration of geodesic paths. In kind of the flat space Newtonian limit, that means more curvature is more gravitational field. Okay, so now we've hand-waved our way through enough stuff that we can look at Einstein's equations. Okay. So what Einstein did was, as we said before, he required a theory in which the gravitational field is replaced by space-time curvature. And space-time curvature is generated by mass or energy or something like that. It's generated by stuff, right? Because the gravitational field we expect to be generated by stuff. And then the motion of particles under the gravitational influence is described by the geodesics. And these geodesics are properties of the space-time. They're nothing to do with the particle, which is following the trajectory. Particles of different mass will follow the same trajectory. The geodesics are inherent to the space-time, and that was kind of encoded in what the mathematics we were just looking at. And then there are a couple of boring bits, right? You know, you can have great flights of fancy now, but Newtonian gravity works pretty well, right? And special relativity works very well. So that means if the Riemann tensor disappears, there's no curvature, then you better get special relativity back. And if the speed of light goes to infinity, so there is no relativity, you better get Newtonian gravity back, at least in the weak field limit. So that means, basically, that we have to determine the curvature from the stuff, and that means there has to be a formula which says curvature is some constant times amount of stuff. And amount of stuff is the mass of it, the energy of it, and so on. So basically, we double the sources of gravitational field, we double the curvature, and we double the influence on the particles moving in the gravitational field. Okay. Now, the correct choice is actually not at all obvious, and Einstein had some trouble with it. The first equation he wrote down was this one. So he wrote the Ricci tensor is equal to some load of constants, Newton's constants has turned up in there, no, times this thing called the stress tensor. Now, I haven't talked about the stress tensor, I'm not really going to talk about it. The stress tensor is a can of worms. Right? So it's very specific to the particular source you're talking about. In many cases, it's not well understood. Okay? But we do know which choices work in some circumstances. So, for example, if you have a perfect fluid which has a density rho and a pressure p, and it's moving with a 4 velocity u, then this is what the stress tensor is, and that works. Now, this formula Einstein first wrote down, he realized after a bit, didn't work for reasons which are slightly puzzling. So he was concerned about the covariant derivative of this, and actually the covariant derivative of that Nabla object that we wrote down, which involves the Christoffel symbol, This formula is inconsistent if you think that the covariant derivative of the stress tensor should vanish, which was the point of view that Einstein took. So he had to fix that, and he fixed it by adding this extra bit proportional to the Ricci scalar. Now the covariant derivative on both sides is zero and everything is consistent, and that looks good. And then he had a lot of time. He tried to convince himself that he didn't have to put anything else in, but ultimately failed to convince himself that there was nothing else that could go in there. And this is the famous cosmological constant term. There's absolutely no reason why this term shouldn't be present in Einstein's equations. So this is the final form of Einstein's equations. It involves this object, which is the Einstein tensor. The first two terms on the left-hand side are G. It involves the cosmological constant lambda, about which more later. And it involves Newton's constant G, which basically tells you how strong gravity is. And of course, there are various factors of pi and speed of light and stuff floating around to fix up the dimensions and things. Okay. So this is a beautiful set of equations. Okay. So the tensor form, we haven't really gone into this, but the tensor form shows that this is an equation which is true in any coordinate system. So it doesn't matter what coordinate system you use, the equations for generating the curvature from the stuff will always take this form. Okay. And so it rectifies the inconsistency of Newtonian gravity with special relativity. That statement would not be true of Newtonian gravity. Now, unfortunately, right, you know, this tensor, it looks great. You know, these are fantastic equations. They're consistent with everything, and you can write them down on a fraction of a line, all right? But that's because the notation's good. And the notation masks very efficiently the horrendous nature of these equations. So if you unpack it, then the Ricci tensor, this R mu nu, is actually related to the Christoffel symbol by the formula written down. Now, remember that the Christoffel symbol itself, okay, involves the derivatives of the metric. So, a number of comments about this. Firstly, the first two terms on the right-hand side of the Ricci tensor involve the derivative of the Christoffel symbol, so they involve second derivatives of the metric. So, your Einstein's equation are certainly equations which say something like second derivative of the metric equals source term, equals how much matter there is. So it's good that they're second order, but they're very, very non-linear. If you look at the next couple of terms in the Ricci tensor, you've got Christoffel symbol times Christoffel symbol, and Christoffel symbol is proportional to a derivative of metric. So these terms are like derivative of metric squared. So these are very non-linear second order partial differential equations for G. Now, solving them in general, analytically, is just completely impossible. And, so mostly analytic solutions, which are known and we'll hear about later on, all have some simplifying characteristic. Okay? And until relatively recently, really very little was known about solutions to Einstein's equations where you didn't have symmetries and nice things, which made basically most of the stuff to zero. There's been a revolution in the last couple of decades in terms of solving these differential equations numerically, right? And people can now do absolutely amazing things on very high-powered computers. So, people have studied what happens with the collision of black holes and things like this, right? And this work has been done numerically, and it's quite a spectacular tour de force. But this kind of problem has only become accessible in the last decade or so. Okay, so that's where we've got to. We've got Einstein's equations. We've noted that they're horrible and complicated, but at the same time, they are implementing a beautiful set of ideas. So I'm going to stop there, and then after coffee, James and Pedro will tell you about how to use these equations to relate Einstein's ideas to what we actually observe in the universe. Thanks very much.